Hello and welcome to Outside In. My name's John Burns, and this is my podcast for people who like to get out into the hills. Some of us have been able to do that recently, some of us have not. It's a fairly fluid situation right now for reasons that I'm not going to go into. But I've got a really exciting guest today. His book, The Earth Beneath My Feet, has just come out, and it's about his 7,000-mile walk of discovery right the way through the heart of Europe, a really challenging sort of walk. And so I'm really pleased to be able to invite Andrew Terrell onto the show to talk about his book. How are you, Andrew?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. Now, unusually, to be honest, your book starts, it starts with a fall. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how that fall happened.
So, yeah, the book starts with a fall down a mountain in the Swiss Alps, which in some ways was unconnected to the journey that followed. I was living a fairly normal life at the time it happened. I lived in suburban London, which didn't really fulfill me. Life didn't kind of have meaning or purpose back in the suburbs of London, as comfortable as it was. And so I did what many people do. I took all my holidays in the hills. Every weekend, I'd try and head out into the mountains. And when I had a week off, I'd go somewhere like the Alps or the Pyrenees or Scotland or wherever. And it was on one of those journeys that I made some decisions that perhaps weren't the best decisions and had a bit of bad luck, and ended up tumbling 1,000 feet down a glacier. And I think it's fair to say that doing that changed my life. And so having a life-changing moment at the start of the book kind of explained why I did the journey to some degree.
Yeah, I noticed that I'm right in thinking that you had this horrendous fall and you were pretty lucky to get away with it by the sound of it. But you had your fall of 1,000 feet, and then when you sort of got to your feet, if you could say that, you still had another 2,000 feet. Well, there's a lot of feet in this book. You still had another 2,000 feet to get down to some sort of civilization. But you wrote, I remember there's a fairly sort of poignant moment in the book when you wrote about waking up in hospital in amongst clean sheets and safety and just being euphoric in that. Was that the moment you decided that I'm going to do something different with your life, or did it happen after that?
Yeah, it was such a realization that I only have one life, and that the way I was living it, trying to kind of follow the path that everyone else lived, that had been preordained from birth and I was brainwashed to follow, wasn't actually the path I was supposed to be following.
Right.
And it was something I'm not sure I personally may have realized if I hadn't fallen down a mountain. Maybe I would have. I knew I was at a deep level. I knew I was really unhappy because I didn't really like my job. I didn't really like being stuck in the suburbs when all I wanted to be was out in the mountains. Back then, I didn't even really understand why I wanted to be in the mountains. I just knew I enjoyed being in the mountains. I hadn't given it much analysis. But I may not have made that step to give up work, head off into the wild for months on end, you know, choose a very insecure future, if I hadn't had that little nudge of, you know, bouncing down a 50-degree ice slope for 1,000 feet.
It does tend to get your attention. Yes, I can imagine that. Yes. So tell me about what of the route you chose is really right from the tip of Italy, right the way up through Europe, Germany, Denmark, and then Norway and Sweden, right as far as it must go into, I suppose, the Arctic Circle. Why that particular route? What sort of really inspired you about that route?
So, after falling down the mountain, the next summer, when I finally plucked up courage to step away from ordinary life, and I use the term ordinary not to, you know, make real life seem less, because I think you can actually have an extraordinary life within an ordinary existence, as I've discovered since. But after falling down a mountain, I went off to do a 6-month walk in the Alps first. The summer after it, I spent 6 months walking, I don't know, 2,200 miles curving through the Alps, and just fell in love with that wandering way of life. Then the next summer, I went for a 3-month, 1,000-mile meander through the Pyrenees. And I discovered that I liked walking the length of complete mountain ranges in one go. It revealed those ranges in the way shorter visits don't. You know, you get to see how it all fits together and stuff. So I walked the length of the Alps. I walked the length of the Pyrenees. I was looking at a map of Europe, and I saw the way the mountains stretch all the way up Norway, you know, 1,000 miles of rugged Norwegian fjells and fjords and forests.
Yeah.
All those F words, but not those F words. And then I was looking at a map, and I also saw the Apennines, the mountain range that stretches the length of the Italian peninsula.
Yeah.
And I was trying to decide which of those mountain ranges I should do next. And I was back at work temporarily doing a freelance graphic design job. And I think I looked at I considered both ranges and thought, well, why not walk both Norway and the Apennines in one go? And someone sitting near me said, "That's too far. Can't do that." And I didn't realize I'd spoken aloud, but apparently I had. And them simply saying it's too far kind of got me thinking, well, what if I joined them together? What if I did a walk that linked the Apennines and Norway, like two of Europe's mountain ranges I hadn't really visited yet? And then, you know, join them together by curving through the Alps and then following the mountains of Central Europe and then maybe walking up the Danish North Sea coast. What if I made it one journey? And the more I thought about it, the more it appealed for so many different reasons. You know, the varieties of climate zones and the differences in countries and culture, to walk from southern Italy, which is known as the land of the midday sun, the Mezzogiorno, and then walking up to northern Norway, which of course is the land of the midnight sun.
Yeah.
There was something so poetic about linking those two places.
Right. And so you weren't following then an established route. This was something that you sat down and visualized yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. When I did it, I didn't know there was a trail that I think goes from Naples all the way to Norway, although I don't think it was fully blazed and established at the time I did my walk back in 97 and 98. And I've never liked the idea of following official trails that other people have prepared and planned for me. Mm-hmm. For me, heading out is so much more rewarding when it's almost a make it up as you go affair type of thing, where you don't know what's going to happen and you don't have to stick to a route set in stone. You can change depending upon how you feel by the day or whatever fate and circumstance throws up in front of you. It's kind of fun to just let chance take control, as it were.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously you were a pretty experienced long distance walker really before you started this. Probably you needed to be, I would have thought. But tell us about the Apennines. What was that like? Because that's quite rugged landscape, isn't it?
It's a fascinating range for so many reasons. One of the fascinating things is that so few people seem to visit that range or even know about it. I think the mountains of the Abruzzo in the center of the Apennines and maybe the northern Apennines are a little better known. I think there are some guidebooks to the mountains. But again, it's not on the radar of most people back in England or Scotland. You know, we think about the Alps or the Pyrenees or
Or
mountains closer to home. The southern Apennines especially are completely off the radar. And it's amazing to me because, you know, Italy gets 60 million visitors a year in a normal year, not the last couple of years. And when I've spoken to people I know who love Italy, they have barely heard of this mountain range. And yet it's this fantastic mountain range that stretches the length of the country that has so much to offer. But it didn't meet my expectations when I started. Back when I did this journey, there was very little chance to do research. The internet didn't really exist and I had no access to it anyway.
Right. This is 1997, roughly, isn't it?
Yeah, 1997. The internet was like 5% of what it is now, and I didn't even have my own computer anyway, or I didn't even have an email address back then. You know, it was a different world.
Different world, yeah.
I couldn't find any detailed maps of the mountains. I found a few pictures in one general guidebook to Italy, And the picture just showed mountains that were dry and rugged looking and open and stony. And so that's what I was expecting. And I'd also based it on walking a length of the Pyrenees, which are of a similar latitude, and they rise above the Mediterranean Sea as well. And so I thought, it's just going to be like the Pyrenees. And it wasn't. I got there and climbed up into my first range of mountains known as the Aspromonte, which is the rough mountain. And I discovered mountains that were completely covered in forest, that barely had any trails, that were steep-sided. And I spent 2.5 of the first 5 days completely and utterly lost, with no real idea where I was. The map was useless. I didn't manage to acquire a map of Calabria, where the journey started, until a couple of days before I actually begun the journey. And it was a really difficult start because it was forested. It wasn't open as I expected. I couldn't walk in the way I wanted, which was, you know, nice, easy wandering across open mountains the way we have back in England. It was just tangled, almost like jungle walking. And so it became a really hard start to the journey because I had this expectation of what my journey was going to be. And the reality was nothing like that. It was in at the deep end.
That's really quite remarkable in a way, because you think about how well explored and how well known Europe is. And yet, from what you're saying, it's almost not unexplored stretching it, but basically a pretty wild and little known area, right in the center of Italy. Is that fair?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's kind of one of the themes of the book itself, is exploring these places that not many people go to. And in some parts of the Apennines, I mean, I could imagine years and years pass without some certain corners getting touched by human feet. And it's the fact that Europe is seen to be this over-civilized, over-developed, overrun continent.
Actually, one of the things that I found quite fascinating, and I think it kind of meshes with my experience in a way, in that, as you say, you know, you think of places like Scotland, relatively speaking, as pretty well-known, pretty well-explored. And you said the same thing about the Alps. And yet there was one sort of passage that really interested me. You talked about crossing a glacier in the Alps, and how, despite the fact, I suppose, that there were villages not that far away, you were alone in a wild place. Is that how it felt a lot of the time?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Europe is seen as this, you know, overdeveloped, over-civilized, overrun continent where you can't have adventure. And I even had people kind of laugh at me when I said I'm going off for a wilderness walk in Europe, because they didn't think you could find any wilderness or any wild, truly wild places. Mm-hmm. But from southern Italy all the way up the length of the Apennines into the Alps, out of season especially, I felt like I'd stepped into this parallel continent that lots of people do visit from time to time, but fewer people really fully immerse themselves in it for weeks and months at mm-hmm. a time. And yeah, it was like discovering this alternate universe that still exists out there that it doesn't really take much to access.
And was that something that surprised you then? I mean, it must have been not. Was that what you expected, or was it very different?
That's a good question. I kind of expected it, because I'd done enough walking back in England and in the Alps and the Pyrenees to know that what I was looking for I could find. And when I began the journey, all I really wanted from it was just to spend time in the mountains. There was no lofty goal about becoming a better person or exploring places other people didn't explore. The real purpose was, I knew I liked being in the mountains. I didn't know why, because I hadn't really thought about it. And I just wanted to spend as much time in the mountains as possible. And that was where the journey really, really began. Mm-hmm. And I knew that when I got out there, I would have a good time, because that's what I like to do. And so all the other stuff kind of came from that, because of the length of time the journey took and some of the challenges that I hadn't expected. It ended up becoming something a little more meaningful than I ever imagined it could be.
Well, you talked about special challenge. What were the most challenging aspects of what is a pretty challenging walk all the way, really, I would have thought?
So I didn't expect my emotions to get challenged in quite the same way they did. I kind of knew there'd be physical challenges, and I knew there'd be ups and downs, and I knew I'd be hungry and tired and thirsty and sometimes lost, and I'd, you know, get blisters back in the days when I used to hike with big hiking boots, which I don't do anymore. But I didn't expect the sheer length of time to create a journey that had so much meaning, because I put so much of myself into it. You know, meaning grows when you really invest yourself in any project, as I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't expect that loneliness would rise in the way it did. I was kind of a solitary kid. I had a really bad stammer growing up.
Right.
And that made me prefer spending time by myself. And it's why one of the reasons why I end up growing to love the hills, because out in the hills I could relax, because there was little chance anybody would come up to me and start talking to me. And I would fall into that pit of despair when I can't get past the start of a certain word. So I was safe in the hills. So that was one of the reasons I went. And so I kind of convinced myself, I think, that I could live on my own without needing other people. But spending 18 months on my own, especially as winter started to hit, I suddenly realized, slowly dawned on me that perhaps I wasn't quite the island I thought I was. And that became a real challenge, especially into the second book, which I can't talk about too much because it's not out for a little while yet.
But yeah, right.
It's certainly hinted at in the latter stages of The Earth Beneath My Feet.
Mm-hmm. And was that something to do with you? You're obviously moving north. You're moving into places. Well, you talked about the midnight sun already. You are talking about moving into places where it's going to be dark for large periods of swathes of time. Did that make a big difference to you, or is that nonsense?
Yeah, the darkness didn't really trouble me. And I think there were physical challenges from camping through a winter.
Right.
As I'm sure you know, camping in Scotland in winter isn't necessarily a pleasant situation, especially when you're doing it. You imagine doing it week after week after week after week after week, and yes, dealing with the dampness that just keeps growing that you have to fight, and waiting to a frosted tent every morning. Not that you have those problems with your hot tent, which just looks so wonderful. I could have done with that.
Yeah. I think you might have had a hard job carrying that over 7,000 miles, but yeah.
There is that. That's true. But, you know, so that there are the physical challenges of learning coping tricks with dealing with winter, and the final stages of The Earth Beneath My Feet, you know, takes you into the depths of winter in the Alps when the snows finally hit and life changed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think it was the emotional challenge of accepting that I was on my own, and I had a way out. I could just quit if I wanted to, but quitting never crossed my mind. So it was dealing with knowing that I was going to keep pushing on despite feeling separated from everybody else and having chosen to be separate from society. You know, it's essentially homeless by choice, which is obviously very different from the homelessness that many people face.
Sure.
But having to deal with it and knowing that I wasn't going to let myself stop because I didn't want to, because I was doing what I wanted to do. It was just an interesting mix of conflicting emotions and needs.
I mean, it is interesting in that you talked about the internet, and in a way you were doing this journey probably in the last few years of a period where it was normal, or you could actually be alone. Because these days, you know, if you were to do that walk today, then actually you could be interconnected on an awful lot of the time with the rest of the, well, not the outside world's not the right word, but with the rest of the world, maybe. Does that kind of make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. I actually had internet reports going up. There was a website that doesn't exist anymore. But what happened was I wrote the reports out by hand and then stuck them in the post and posted them home from some random post office in the middle of nowhere. Some of them made it back. Not all of them did, because the Italian Postal Service back in those days was very good at consuming mail, both the parcels I sent to myself with food in it and some of the posts I sent back, just disappeared into nowhere. And so the stories that I sent back only appeared 3 weeks after I wrote them.
God, that's incredible, isn't it? When you think where we are today, you know?
It was different.
You could live stream today.
Except that if I were to do that journey again, I wouldn't. I would leave that behind because I think it would distract me from what I was immersing myself in.
Right. Yeah. I went to Alex Roddy, who you know, did a very similar thing on the Cape Wrath Trail and made a conscious decision to leave technology, or to leave at least the his communications devices, his devices that allowed him or forced him to keep in touch with social media and stuff like that. Is that something then that you think that you would consciously reject, really?
I think I would, because the reason I go out into the mountains, whether it's for a few hours or for months, is to really connect with the places I'm in. And it's why on long journeys, I'd always prefer to do it by myself, because I think even if you're with one other person, that's pulling your attention away from the moment that you're in when you're actually out in the mountains. And so I think if you had outside distractions pulling you away from it, it dilutes the moment you've gone for, if that makes sense. And it sounds kind of a little highfalutin and stuff, but it's a reality of living in the moment is one of the things the journey taught me, which I tried to carry through to real life when I got back to it. And I think, I just went away for a little 2-night walk in the Rockies close to where I live, and I didn't take my phone with me. I had my camera for taking a few pictures, but that was the only real technology.
Yeah. Getting away from technology then into more practical things. I saw quite a few references to dogs in your book. Dogs both friendly and aggressive. And I wonder what you'd learned about dealing with confrontations with dogs and generally speaking with wild animals.
Yeah, there were a few dogs. It wasn't really a main feature of the journey. But in the south of Italy, there are a lot of wild dogs that are just running around. Lots of farm dogs that are never chained up. So whenever I dropped to the valleys to walk through them, I'd always have that anticipation of some angry farm dog coming out, charging at me. And I used my long walker's ice axe as my walking stick back in those days, rather than trekking poles.
All right.
So having my ice axe, which I called Excalibur, in hand, to wave at the dogs was always useful. Or I learned that, you know, just to stoop down and pretend to pick up stones would be enough to have the dogs know what was coming and turn tail and dash off in the opposite direction. But, you know, there were encounters with sheepdogs who were guarding flocks of upland sheep. And the sheepdogs are trained to defend against wolves. So when a hiker turns up, you know, they just have this instinct to not let you pass, which caused a number of route changes, not wanting to be savaged by these, you know, mighty white polar bear type Marimano sheepdogs. But I learned ultimately that just ignoring the dogs usually sucked the wind from their sails, until I made the mistake of doing that with 5 dogs just when the south of Italy was finishing. And they kind of surrounded me, barked at me, but I just ignored them while I was sat there taking a break. And eventually they kind of settled down, and I made the mistake of throwing them a few crumbs of biscuits I was carrying. And after that, they decided they wanted to join me on my hike to Norway. And hiked along. That made me concerned that they weren't going to be able to find their way home. And so the roles changed. I ended up, you know, barking and shouting at them to scare them away, because I'd messed with the natural order of things.
I see.
But wildlife in general, it wasn't an issue. I had probably a bear, pass by my tent twice one night. We camped in the Abruzzo. I saw snakes. I saw footprints from wolves, I think, even though they were out there a lot. I Yeah, there were no bad wildlife encounters at all. The dogs
Oh,
were
well,
probably
that's pretty good, really, when you consider the sort of distance that you covered, you know?
Indeed, yeah. But
Incredible, really. And when you you did make some references then to posting food in advance. Was it relatively easy to keep restocked with food over the times when you were pretty low on supplies at times?
so the beautiful thing about Europe is the wilderness isn't vast,
Right.
right? So you can choose how long you want to spend away from towns. I mean, even in southern Italy, I 3 or 4 days between towns was probably the most I needed to go. Sometimes I stretched it a bit longer just because I wanted that immersion in nature, civilization. So it was pretty easy to not have to carry too much of an epic size pack, although I ended up carrying a ridiculous rucksack because I'm useless at traveling light, especially back then.
Right.
There was one point in the Alps where I had 9 paperbacks in my rucksack just because I wasn't carrying a Kindle. I had books that I really enjoyed that I wanted to read for a second or third time in the evenings, and so I didn't want to post them back to England or leave them somewhere for someone else to read. So I had a very silly size rucksack,
That's amazing.
and I also carried more fresh food than many backpackers would, because I would rather put real vegetables in my dinner and have an apple every day or
Right.
two or three. And I like head up into the hills for 2 days, and I'd have a bag of 10 apples mixed in with all the other silly heavy stuff I was carrying. So I was not a good example of traveling light.
Well, I don't. I think what you said really about the sort of length of time that you were actually out. I mean, I know that you can buy what I suppose is pretty nutritious dehydrated food these days, but I do wonder that if you lived on that for months on end, whether that would actually have a be a particularly good diet, you know?
That was one of the things. I didn't want to live off dehydrated food for 18 months. I don't
No,
think
no,
it would
no.
I don't think it'd be good for you.
No, I think it would now.
I actually finished the journey weighing exactly the same as I started 18 months later, and a skinny 140 pounds. That's all I am. And I didn't get a single cold, or real stomach upset throughout the journey. So I guess I was doing something right on that front of things.
That's quite incredible to have done that sort of d distance and not change weight at all, isn't it, really?
But I
Because
think 7,000 miles sounds like a lot, but I know some outdoor athletes who have done 7,000 mile journeys in, 8 months, and I was spending 18 months on it, which means I wasn't pushing really hard. I'd have hard days and I'd get tired and thirsty, but I was really crawling across the surface of Europe slowly, and it's essentially a whole bunch of really short days added together, which makes it sound impressive, but I don't think it was an athletic feat at all. It was just a whole bunch of slow walks, one after the other. And if you don't push too far beyond your limit, then you can keep
Right, it sounds strenuous enough to me, I have
going.
to say. Especially carrying 9 paperbacks and a big bag of apples. But
But
tell me, sorry, go on. You're now this is your first book that's been out a few weeks now, is it? And you're working now. This book takes your journey as far as going through the Alps, I think, and then you're
correct.
working now on volume two. Is that right? Where does volume two take us?
So volume two picks up at Salzburg on the northern side of the Alps, where the first book finishes. And then
Right.
it leads all the way through the center of Europe in the middle of winter, and then to the bottom of Norway. I took a ferry from Denmark to start the final stage.
Aha, yeah. Well, you had to, really, didn't you?
Yeah, some people told me you should rent a kayak or you should swim, and
Oh, no,
kind
that's
of
not it.
wasn't really what I was doing. I just wanted to spend time in the mountains. So the sooner I
Yes,
got
yes.
to Norway, the better. And then yeah, it takes you it takes it, it it describes the journey all the way to the North Cape at the top of Norway. So the second book is written. I still have some edits to do to it and preparations to make to help it tell the full story. Because, as you know from writing, John, that the more you write, the more you discover depths and motivations behind the journey that you didn't even necessarily grasp at the time. And so that's come out for me while I've been writing the books. And it's been, you know, it's almost like a whole separate journey. And so I'm still finishing the writing journey for the second book, even though the actual thing finished 24 years ago.
Right, right. And in many ways, it must have taken, I mean, certainly I know when I write about my outdoor experiences, it often takes you back, you kind of re-experience it again.
So much, yeah. It's fantastic. You get to do the same journey twice when you get to do it in two completely different ways.
You get to do it sitting down, which is often a great way to do it. So when do you anticipate that your second volume's coming out?
I'm currently thinking it's not going to be until June 1st next year.
Right,
so
yeah,
It's a bit of a break, but I'm new to this publishing world. And so this first one, I just wanted to get done and out because it felt like if I didn't do it, I never would. And it's kind
absolutely
of like the journey itself, because when I started that journey, I only had funds to pay for 6 months of food, not for 18.
Right, right.
And so I started thinking, well, if I don't start, I'm just never going to do it. And so I started, and it was a real step of faith. And part of the story is how that worked out. And it wasn't always easy, not having money doing a journey like that. But eventually it worked out, obviously, or I wouldn't have two books about it.
Well, it sounds amazing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so doing the book, the first book was a little bit like that. But because I just wanted to get it out, I didn't have the means or the know-how to really publicize it before launching it. And I've learned a lot since going through the whole process. So now I'm hoping that with the second book, I can get a little more momentum going and reach a broader audience than just the hiking niche.
Definitely.
It a little more ahead of time. So we'll see how that goes.
Great. Well, I hope it. I really wish you all the best with your publishing and your books. That sounds really interesting. And so you'll have to come on if you are very keen to talk to you again about the second half of your journey, where when you actually do publish volume two, I suppose. So
I'd love to come back. Thank you.
Brilliant. Well, that would be great. We'd love to talk to you again. And so just to finish off your book, The Earth Beneath My Feet, by Andrew Terrell, is available through Amazon and I think direct from yourself, is that right?
At the moment only through Amazon.
Only through Amazon, okay.
Hopefully it should be available to order through bookstores too. If it's not now, it should be very shortly.
If the system
works the way it's supposed to, but when does it ever do that?
not often. It's a beautiful book, and it's full of interesting photos and some great stories. So Andrew, thanks very much for talking to me, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again. Take care
until then. Bye.